Hi everybody, this is Chris DC, and it was such a pleasure this week to interview Angela Puka. Angela is based at Leeds Trinity University. She's a PhD student, and we talk about how we can no longer have physical conferences during lockdown, and we learn why she moved to the UK from Italy in order to do her doctorate. Now, we learn that Angela, who sticks to a daily writing schedule, has her own YouTube channel. It's called Angela's Symposium, and it's dedicated to the academic study of magic, paganism, witchcraft, and esotericism. Angela tells me about the reasons for its inception. We discuss why the journey is often more important than the final product, and Angela talks about her Italian background and how her academic journey began and why she is interested in contemporary work on witchcraft. We discover where her interest in magic comes from and how it is a way for people to connect beyond the five senses. Now, Angela tells me why we create rather than find our own meaning. And we discover that she used to sing in metal bands and is also trained to sing opera. She has also performed in musicals, and we learn who her favourite poet is and why she likes the films of David Lynch, which she explains awakens something within us which we don't necessarily understand. Now, Angela and I talk about the need to know what the classical methods and structures are before we can be in a position to break those rules. And she explains why she recalls positive memories more than the negative ones. We discuss how COVID has shown how resilient we are, and we learn that Angela's teenage self wouldn't be surprised at what she is doing now. And then towards the end of the interview, Angela reveals why she loved school so much and why she wanted to study for the rest of her life. And we learn why she would define herself as a looking forward type of person with nostalgic tendencies. It was so good to catch up via Zoom with Angela from Leeds for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Right. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Angela Puka on the line, and we know each other a little bit. Well, of course, we know each other through your wonderful YouTube video, and you'll no doubt want to talk about that in a moment. But you're based in Leeds, aren't you?
Yes. I'm based at Leeds Trinity University at the moment. And thank you for inviting me here, Chris. It's really a pleasure to be here on your podcast.
No, it's an absolute pleasure, because I watched your podcast, your YouTube channel, and I see you interviewing sometimes the very people that I either have interviewed or want to interview. And I listen to your work, and you do lots of stuff on magic. Well, you can tell us in a minute what you do. And I just thought, no, this is wonderful to get a sense of your background, your motivation, sort of what led you to do the kind of work and the research and the teaching that you're doing now. So that's just terrific. And we met, of course, at the BASR, the BASRA conference, the British Association for the Study of Religion, a year ago, back in the days when, of course, we were able to meet people person to person. So how has the last year been for you since we've all gone online?
Oh, well, I wrote up my thesis, my PhD thesis, and submitted. So now I'm waiting for my viva, for my thesis defense to be arranged. But yeah, I really do miss the conferences and all the lovely chats we used to have over meals and coffee and everything. Yeah. Because it is a nice aspect and a nice part of our academic job to meet other people and collaborate. I just love to collaborate with other researchers. It always opens up your perspectives, and you learn many new things.
And is it something that's very different to what you imagined it would be? Because when anybody starts on a PhD, even though you've got the prerequisites of an undergraduate degree or maybe a master's, it's, you know, everybody, I think, goes through a crisis of faith of sorts, and they're like, "Ooh, okay, this is not how I expected it to go." And then at the end of it, you have this finished product, which probably bears very little resemblance to what you necessarily embarked on at the very beginning. Is that your experience?
Yes. I think it's the experience of most PhD students. Yeah, basically To me, the PhD was difficult in so many respects. I was extremely lucky that I had Suzanne Owen, who was my amazing and lovely supervisor, and she helped me through it all. But for me, it was difficult for many reasons. For once, I moved to a different country to pursue my academic career because it wasn't possible for me in Italy to pursue this for the kind of subject matter that I'm interested in. And so I had to move to a different country. Suddenly I found myself speaking in a different language, and not only that, but I had to write in a different language to an academic level. So I was, of course, terrified. And also both my bachelor's and my master's were in philosophy. And now I found myself doing research in anthropology of religion. And so I immediately realized that it was very different, and I had to relearn everything from scratch. it was really difficult. And especially the first year and a half, I felt at times as if I would have never made it. Honestly, it was really difficult for me, and everything I used to write was not as good as I wanted it to be. But then over time and by doing, and it's really trial and error, and you need to do more and worry less. That's what I realized. And then I created like a daily schedule, a daily writing schedule that I had to stick to. And I actually did, even when I was doing field work in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. So I just decided, okay, I'm going to stick to this schedule. Every time at this time of the day, I will be writing. And yeah, the more you write, the more you learn how to write academically, of course, and even, I guess, in general.
I found that because I feel I've got at least two hats on, because as well as my academic work, I've always kept a diary. But there's the commitment with that. And, you know, when we're all, and I do film reviews as well. So, you know, when we're all very busy people, sometimes it's easy to say, oh, well, I won't do that today, or I'll leave. I'll do it another time. And then, of course, you never get, once you kick something into the long grass, it never gets done. But if you set aside time, like, I mean, a good example actually today, because I interviewed somebody else just before this one. And normally I'd think, gosh, I've got, you know, what are my plans today? I need to record a lecture for next week. And I thought, I've got a few emails to send. How am I going to have time to record two interviews? But of course, if you really want to do something, you make time, and then everything else fits in. So whereas the other jobs, sometimes you might spend the whole day doing, you know, you take your time over the course of the day, because you've got, say, an interview at 2 o'clock and one at 4 o'clock, then suddenly in the morning, it's so precious. You say, in order to do those interviews at 2 and 4, I need to get this done by 1 o'clock. And I did it. And just after 1 o'clock, I thought, oh, I've actually achieved all of the things that I set out to do. But normally it would take me the whole day to do it rather than just the morning. So, yeah, PhDs are interesting. Once you get the recipe right, once you know what the formula is, and you have to arrive at it on your own. You can read books and talk to other people, but it has to be one that's right for your life situation. And then once you've found it, you never want to relinquish it. Was that your experience?
Yes, absolutely. And I totally agree that it is a very personal thing, because you have to find your own recipe. Like in my case, my most productive time is very early in the morning. But I know that there are people who are more productive in the evenings or even at night. So you really have to find what works for you and try and just find your way.
Well, I think that's right, because I find that I get more tired when I don't have things to do. So sometimes on the weekend, you know what it's like in the week, and you sometimes think, oh, I can't wait for the weekend to, quote, wind down. And then Saturday or Sunday, you get up a bit later sometimes, and then I feel just even more exhausted. And I think, but hang on, in the week, I was doing a million and one things, and I had all this energy. And I think that's it. So once you've found, you know, you don't want to do too much. You can't take on more than you can handle. But once you've found the right balance, never give up and never let go. So once you know that you have to write X number of words a day, if you do that, and then suddenly by the end of a week, you think, oh, actually, I've written a decent amount. Then after a month, 2 months, 3 months, you suddenly find that the end is inside rather than this impossible project, which, you know, sort of becomes, takes on mythological properties then of this, the fear associated with something that you know that you need to do, but can't quite get a hold on.
Yeah, because it is something gigantic, a PhD thesis. Mine certainly was. Yeah, it ended up being almost 100,000 words. So
yeah, and over the course of some years, but I found certainly that I was writing more towards the end than I was, you know, at the beginning. You the first year you do a lot of tinkering sometimes, and you say, oh, I need to get that right, and you rewrite it and you rephrase it, and you go back over and over again. And then of course by the time you finish, you think, actually, I don't need it at all. But I spent so much time at the beginning working on it, I have to find room for it somewhere. But you get what I'm saying, is that you find your own voice.
And also, in order to cut out time for to write up my thesis, during the past year, I took a sabbatical from teaching, because I also had a teaching contract at Leeds Trinity University, which I still have in a different capacity. But yeah, for the past year, I didn't really teach, because I wanted to focus on my thesis. But then I also started my YouTube channel, Angela Symposium, and because maybe I just needed to teach somehow. It's just in my blood or something. But yeah, it was also a way for me to... My YouTube channel, by the way, is called Angela Symposium. I'm not sure I said it or not. But yeah, it is about the academic study of magic and magic practicing religions and traditions. Because I thought that magic tends to be under-researched and under-taught when it comes to academic, you know, to religious studies in academia. So I guess I wanted to fill the gap and also make that knowledge available to a wider audience.
And how did that start then? Because was it an offshoot of the PhD? Were you finding that you wanted to interview some of the people whose work you were researching?
No, I guess at first it started out just because I wanted to, I guess what really prompted me was the fact that I realized that the communities who are interested in paganism, witchcraft, Western esotericism, and these kind of things tend to really value academic research. And there is even a book who talks about it, which is The Scientification of Religion by von Stackhardt. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but his work was amazing. And there are like a few chapters on the influence of academia on both the rebirth or the birth of paganism in the Western world and shamanism, the popularization of shamanism in Europe and in the Western world in general. And you can really tell how this community really, how impactful academia and academic research was on these communities. And so I thought that they might in fact be interested in knowing what is going on. And many people comment on my videos saying that they had no idea, no clue whatsoever, that there was so much research done on those kind of topics. And even I, when I was in Italy before I moved to the UK, I really had no idea that you could pursue these kind of topics from an academic point of view. And I think that people need to know that this can be done.
Yeah. No, well, actually, it sounds a bit similar to what I was doing with film, because I mean, it seems almost passé now, but back in the early 90s, doing something on theology or religion and film wasn't common practice. Now I think so much has been published, even since I did my PhD, that it's quite commonplace to have university departments that look at, say, religion and film. But it's always really nice. I mean, obviously in those days we didn't have podcasts, but when you can disseminate what you're doing in a way that isn't just going to be read by a very select number of people who are, say, your examiners. If you can do something, which I've only really been using Facebook for the last 3 years, but I find it such a wonderful tool for, in a more popular way, just saying, this is what I'm doing. Because otherwise, I don't want to be the sort of person who in years to come, people would say, oh yeah, Chris DC, every 4 years or so, we had a book out in something. You think, yeah, but what about the process involved in that? What about the journey to that book and all the different steps along the way? It's nice to share that with people. But if they're interested, rather than just sort of waiting for that moment when a book comes out that people may or may not read. Your students might read them and your peers will read them. But generally speaking, it's I think, important to have an awareness or to show people sometimes the process of getting that out rather than just saying, here's the finished product. It's the journey there rather than just the end goal or the destination that I think is important.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And the journey is just as important, if not more important, than the final product, because the final product is something which is still, and when it is done, it is kind of an inanimate object, whereas the journey is a process, is dynamism and a work in progress, potentiality, which can go in any way.
Yeah, but how did the journey start for you? Because you mentioned Italy. So do you want to say a little bit about your background? Because I'm taking you were born in Italy?
Yes, yeah. I am born and raised in Italy, as you may tell by my accent. I did my undergraduate, in Italy, if we want to start very early, I did my high school at classical high school, it's called in Italy, where you study Latin, Greek, philosophy, and all the classical subjects as they are classified in Italy. Then for both my undergrad and my master's degrees, I did philosophy, both Eastern and Western philosophies. And at first I wanted to become an academic in Buddhist studies. So I also studied and learned for about 4 years Sanskrit and Tibetan. And I also studied briefly at the University of Hamburg in Germany. But yeah, at first I wanted to, I guess I've always been interested in both philosophy and religions, and also the intersections between the two. But then another thing that always interests me was magic and the different kind of traditions and religions that incorporate magic. So even when I was trying to pursue Buddhist studies, I was still mainly focused on tantric Buddhism and for example, the cult around Kurukula, which is the Dakini of magic, as she's been called. So even in that case, I guess that I still kind of gravitated around the idea of magic. And when I realized that it was in fact possible to study these kind of things from an academic point of view, then I decided that I absolutely wanted to do a PhD on this. But as I said, in Italy, it's still undeveloped as a subject area. And so I decided to try and apply elsewhere. And I applied to Leeds Trinity and they accepted me and also offered me a teaching position. So that was amazing. I already remember when I got the news that I got the post, I felt so happy. It's really indescribable how I felt. It was like 7 straight days where I was like on seventh heaven or something.
Well, because that's the thing, isn't it? Because when you feel that there's something that you can't study, it may, or you don't think that there's a precedent for doing it, like you were saying about magic. I'd love to unpack all of that in just a minute. But you must have found that, you know, in order to be able to study something about which you're so passionate, which isn't just an interest of yours, but it's like it's opening the floodgates for other people, because it's like you, now that you're doing this, you're now making it, as, and I guess the analogy is what I did with film in the 90s, you make it academically acceptable. There's no reason why somebody else can't, whether it's directly in magic or whatever their area of specialism, that there's no boundary. No one is saying, sorry, you're not allowed to do this. But did you come across that sort of resistance before? Did you just think that you couldn't do it because you weren't aware of work in this area, or were you actively told, sorry, you're not allowed to study this for whatever reason?
At first in Italy, you know, when you are from a specific place, you tend to look up research from your country or in your own language. So at first I wasn't quite aware. I mean, I already knew Ronald Hutton when I was in Italy, but that was a historical study on witchcraft, whereas I was more interested in the contemporary manifestations of witchcraft. So I guess that I just, when I was an undergraduate and a master's student, I just didn't come across anyone doing these kind of studies. And since I was kind of ingrained in the Italian culture, it was more difficult perhaps to come across those kind of research. And then on YouTube, I came across a video by Jenny Butler. And yeah, she was another, yeah, I guess she, I really like her. You met us at
I met you two together, so because I always associate you because I met the two of you at the same time. Yeah,
yeah. I think that at the last conference I was to, a couple of people called me Jenny. So I don't know if we if we look alike, or maybe it's just that we both tend to dress in black or something like that. But yeah, I came across a YouTube video where Jenny was explaining her PhD research. And it was on Irish witchcraft. And it was like enlightening to me, a turning point. Like, what? She's studying that? Is it possible to study that for a doctorate? It was just a turning point in that I just realized that it was in fact possible to study these kind of matters from an academic point of view. And so I decided I have to find a way.
And how did the interest in magic all start? Because it sounds like everything to do with mythology, is that, you know, from childhood as well. This sounds like it's something that you're doing now, not the quintessence, the culmination of all the sort of stuff, all the interest that you've had over a long period. That's what's coming across to me anyway, that this is a real labor of love for you.
Yes, it is. Where does my interest in magic come from? I'd say that what interests me the most is knowledge. And that's why I chose philosophy for both my degrees. And I see in magic as, I guess that I'm really in line with the Italian Renaissance. In the Italian Renaissance, they saw magic, and specifically natural magic, as the practical aspect of natural philosophy. So they thought that they called the natural philosophy what we now call science, and they thought that the practical manifestation or the practical counterpart of science was magic. So it was an aspect of knowledge which not only would put science in practice but also discover the occult forces which also underlie any kind of knowledge. So I guess that since the driving force for me has always been knowledge and philosophy, I see in magic the occult philosophy, a philosophy that goes beyond or tries to. And so it is, I see the yearning for the human beings have for something that goes beyond. Mm-hmm. It is similar to religion, but in a non-institutionalized way, and also in a way that would change their lives directly somehow. And yeah, I see magic as this aspect in religious practices which really helps people. And also another thing that fascinates me about magic is connection. So both the driving and the yearning for something that goes beyond the limitations of our human existence, which has been conceptualized in different ways across traditions, because they all find those boundaries to be different, and how can you expand them, and to what extent they all see these kind of things in different way depending on the tradition and the time and the place. But beside that, also the connection. So the idea that with magic, maybe it can be associated, although it's not quite the same as meditation, but through magic, there are many practitioners, especially in shamanism, because my PhD was on shamanism and folk magic in Italy, which I argue to be the Italian indigenous shamanism, but that's a spoiler alert for my thesis. But yeah, I also see in magic a way for people to connect with the elements, connect with nature, connect with other human beings to a level which your five senses won't allow. So it is a way to overcome our, I wouldn't say just limitations, but also to experience life to a degree where your daily life wouldn't allow you to.
Yeah, and when you were, say, growing up, when you were at school, I mean, did you find that the interests that you had were very similar to or very different from those of your peers? In other words, you'd be promoting areas. I mean, it's easy to look back now when you're doing academic work in this sort of area, but did you kind of feel that you always knew looking back that this was something that you were destined to do, that you wouldn't have a fulfilled life or career without doing work in this area? And how different was that from what some of your peers were doing when you were at school or university?
Well, you know, your question just sparked a memory. I just remember that when I was 14, I was just lying on a couch and I was with a friend of mine, with a peer of mine. We were studying Latin and we were just doing our homeworks. And during one of the breaks, I had this very strong feeling and I told her, she used to be my best friend at the time. I told her, I have the feeling that I have to do something important which relates to religion. At the time, I really didn't know what it might have been, and I wasn't really that educated in religions because I only really knew about Catholicism. But yeah, I do remember that there was this time, I don't know where it came from, but it was this strong feeling that I had that I still remember to this day, and that your question actually made resurface. So I had this very strong feeling, I will be doing something important about religions that has something to do with religions.
Yeah, I mean, hindsight is a wonderful thing because I obviously do this work on nostalgia, but when I was at school and to an extent university, you know, there are all these avenues which are all these doors opening up, but you never quite know which ones you're going to go through. And then when you then have to, and sometimes it can be a luxury of going back to some of those people from your past who might have said to you, as happened to me sometimes, why are you studying religion? You know, why are you doing the sciences? Why didn't you do something that makes money? And, you know, sort of, yeah, I'd have though, you know, some really gifted people at school who went into the sciences rather than into the arts. And I always used to feel very wary during the school holidays when you'd go back and meet them again in your hometown, because you'd be thinking you have to defend what you're doing. Often this was all in your head and it wasn't like that at all, but it's often a good process to try and sort of go back and say, well, you know, what makes me, what makes me distinctive, what are the things that I can do and nobody else can possibly do, this is my research, this is my intellectual baby. But it sounds like you've been through that real sort of process yourself, particularly in Italy. You mentioned Catholicism, so it's interesting that you're interested in that sense, trying to ensure that there's an accommodation, you know, with where you're able to study, with the culture, the academic culture of the day. And it seems that you've really found your intellectual home, your spiritual home in Leeds.
Yes, which apparently is also the where interesting magic traditions also come from, like chaos magic, for example, which I made a video about on my YouTube channel. And actually, I got an email from a student saying that that he wants to pursue a PhD at my university on chaos magic. So clearly, that was impactful somehow. But yeah, in my case, I still get that kind of feeling that you used to have. So sometimes, you know, over Christmas, I do have people from the extended family who say that I study weirdo stuff. And yeah, I think that there are still many people that really don't value what I do, academically speaking, but yeah, that's their problem, not mine.
No, it is, because the number of times I can look back to interest that I had when a lot of contemporaries would sometimes just say, oh, that's weird, that's quirky. You know, I had a lot of my friends were really sporty. I've never been interested in sport. And yet the things that I'm passionate about now, I was passionate about when I was younger. You know, I used to spend my evenings recording things off the radio, that kind of thing. And I still got all the tapes and I still use them and I can use them for my research. So I'm glad that I didn't give up and just think, oh, I'll just do what everybody else is doing. You know, so the things that are, when you're really young, quirky things sometimes make people think, oh, you're a bit weird. When you're older, they become distinguished. And like, you're doing this research now, but you're going to be you're the trendsetter. So in years to come, people will be looking at your work as the benchmark. So you're not going to have to be defensive any longer.
Yeah, I hope so. And do you also have the feeling, you know, when you look in hindsight to your past, sometimes it looks like all the clues for the person that you would become were there, like a puzzle that you had to put together, like in your case, as you said, with the recordings and everything?
Well, it's not just that, because I find that it's as though the past me was leaving clues to my future me, because it's like I used to do these things without knowing why I was doing them. Like, I used to record all this stuff off the radio. I digitized a lot of this stuff years later. And whenever I'm in my car and driving, I always listen back to these old tapes, so, you know, 30 years old in some cases. But I do that, and it is transformative, you know. So if I'm traveling on a journey, rather than think, oh, this is a really long journey, and oh gosh, you know, I've got all this traveling to do, will I be tired? It's the opposite, because it's more time to engage with and interact with all the one and wallow in nostalgia with, you know, all the things from my past. So it's almost as though it's like the things that were accidental in the past are now utterly defining of what I do now. And I'm so glad that I didn't just follow the lead set by others, but I followed through on my own designs, quirky and eccentric, no doubt that they may be. So there is that interesting negotiation, but we also look for meaning, I suspect. I don't dispute that, you know, sometimes we try and invent that, but there are certain things which are so indicative of who I am that it feels as though this was going to happen wherever I was, wherever I lived. You know, the journey may have taken me down different paths, but it would ultimately, but if I would have ended up doing the same kind of thing that I'm doing now. That there feels a sense of determinism in that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Do you find meaning in what you do now currently?
But also, of course, I think you must find this as well. In this kind of profession, it's necessary, because there's always that need. I mean, you've got a Viva coming up, but there's that need to defend what you're doing to oneself, not necessarily to others, but that sense of explaining to yourself, why are you doing this? If you're doing something that's a bit different to what most other people are doing, it makes you all the more inclined just to be able to say, this is the reason I'm doing it. And then in a way, you don't have to be defensive anymore, because people just know what you're doing. It becomes such an integral part of you that nobody can imagine you doing anything different to that. So there is that kind of purpose and meaning, I think, which I think without which we wouldn't have any reason to get up in the morning.
Yeah, that is very true. Yeah. Finding our purpose is extremely important, and find meaning, I believe that we kind of create our own meaning rather than find it. But I guess that it's kind of the same depending on how you look at things.
Yeah, well, it can be the same, because I suppose you're finding something that is there within you. This feels very mythological, but you know, it's a sense that it's there to be found, and whether you find it at the right time. You don't want to, I never want to be the person who's old and looking back and thinking, why didn't I do that at a younger age? You know, is it, you know, when it's too late? But in your case, I mean, just thinking of even things like the music or the films, I know that, I think, am I right in thinking that you've got a very big musical, an actual performance musical past as well? You know, have these all impacted on the person that you are?
Yes, in my past life I used to be a singer. I used to sing in metal music bands, and also I'm trained to sing operatic, so I also did musicals, like, for example, one, guess which one I did? Jesus Christ Superstar, because religion just haunts me, even when I don't just look for it. But I did like Jesus Christ Superstar as a musical. And I used to have a few bands. One actually was a folk music band where I used to sing in Neapolitan, which is the vernacular. Actually, it's classified as a language, but as a language by the UNESCO. But yeah, I used to sing in Neapolitan and Italian for that band. But otherwise, I prefer to have goth rock or gothic metal bands. And yeah, there is also something on YouTube, but I use a stage name too, because even at the time, for some reason, I kind of always taught somewhere. So before moving to Leeds, I was teaching in Rome. And so I just didn't want my students to find out, you know, all the performances. I don't know why. Maybe I was just self-conscious because, you know, my metal self was very different from what I saw. But one thing that I really like about the British academia is that, especially in our field, I feel that people are not as concerned with how you dress and your style, so you can be yourself. At least in my experience, and I hope that this will continue to be my experience.
Oh, well, one of my previous interviewees is someone here at Kent who's an academic, not in our subject, but well, actually in the Italian department. But he has a past life, to use your phrase, in a metal band, and that was a big part of our interview. And we were looking at the relationship between the academic self and the other self, and the way they come together. But I actually agree with you. I don't think these are things that necessarily come together when you're still in the process of finding your way through, say, an academic career. When you're a bit more established, I think then it's okay for you to be a bit more sort of out there. I mean, in my case, I wouldn't have felt comfortable 20 years ago putting out the kinds of, obviously Facebook didn't exist then, but I think that I can do things now in a way that I wouldn't have felt comfortable doing when I was a bit younger. And I think that's just because once you found your niche and you have a reputation, then you can start to play with the contours of that. But if you don't quite know which direction you're going in life, then it's you know, you want to be careful sometimes that you don't compromise yourself by saying or doing things that you end up regretting, because you just, you know, you're very young and you just think, no, that's silly. I've made a fool of myself. But somehow later on, it's okay for people to see a bit more of a human side to you, I guess, rather than just associating you with your books and your articles.
Yeah, absolutely. Because otherwise we would just be speaking books, and we aren't. We are people with all sorts of interests. And yeah, I actually wish I could go back to singing and having bands, but I guess it was just removed from my own place and transferred here, and it was difficult to find. And also I had little time because I just focused all my energies on academic related works.
Yeah, I mean, at the stage you're in, I can understand that, but it sounds as though you're bursting in the future to sort of bring those two together in alignment. But they don't seem to be antithetical. They seem actually to complement each other very well, not least because you're the common denominator, and it feels that one can't really function without the other.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. I think in the future it'd be nice to, make songs on academic songs or something. Be fun to have a metal band where you have, you know, references and citations from academics research. I just had this idea. I think it might play out well in the future.
Well, yeah. Well. Hopefully, you'll look back on this interview and say that was the time when I thought, yes, that's the way I'll bring all these things together. But what about, what would you say are the other influences though in your life? I mean, you mentioned music. What about? I mean, one of the things for me when I was really young, it was buying. Well, to an extent buying music, but it was more radio. I mean, it was more, I never really performed. I did play the piano for a little bit, but never really enjoyed that. But there was always this great pleasure involved in listening to things on the radio, not just the music, but also all the talking around that and the contextualizing of it, the time and placeness of it. But did you have, growing up in Italy, the charts was another big thing, you know, the music charts. Was there anything like that that was particularly impactful for you while you were growing up?
Do you mean such as music or?
Yeah, like music charts, that kind of thing. The contemporary music, pop charts, that kind of thing.
Yeah, music was really impactful. And I think that the kind of music that I like has it has some relation to what I study, I think, because in both goth rock and gothic metal, there are themes surrounding, well, not only magic, but even religious questions around religion and our place in reality. They tend to be very mystical at times in terms of the lyrics. I really like both the sound and the lyrics, which are really inspiring. Also, I love poetry and I love literature. So my favorite poet is Fernando Pessoa, who's Portuguese, well, used to be Portuguese poet. And yeah, I really love his work. It's just, there are certain things that when you watch them or read them, they just awake something within you that you didn't even know it existed. And this is something that happens to me when I read Pessoa, or for example, when I watch movies by David Lynch, which I love, like Twin Peaks or other some other films that he has directed. Yeah, there are things that just awake something in you that you didn't know what existed. And sometimes you don't even know what it is that emerges. It's just that they kind of enter within you and move something within. And what comes up from that is, I guess, that you kind of become, I wouldn't say you become a different person, but there is something new within you that you just didn't know it was there, and starts you, from that point onwards, to play a role in the person you are and the things you do. And in some cases, it's even difficult to pinpoint and to say and to label it, because it may be just a feeling. It may be just a deep emotion buried within, that once it emerges, it reshapes and re-angles reality as you saw it.
And sometimes these things are inescapable, because they're such an integral part of who you are that you, and you surprised yourself, because I didn't really watch films at all before I went to university. And yet now, of course, people associate me with my study of film, and I go to the cinema a lot. But I always surprise myself sometimes in doing all of that, because it's something I can't let go of. I know friends who are into sport, and they will travel the world to see their favorite team. What I do is very similar, in some ways a lot cheaper, and I'm luckier because I just have to go to a cinema, or I can watch stuff at home if I need to. But it's that, always that sense of, if something you really like, you don't want it, you can't let it overtake your life to the exclusion of everything else, but you can find pockets for it. So for me, being at work all day, you know, there's a point in the evening when it's like, oh, I'm going to see this at a certain time. And then it sort of grounds the day, it structures the day and gives meaning to the day. And I never lose that capacity to be excited. And I surprise myself sometimes that, you know, you sometimes think, oh, don't you feel a bit bored? Don't you want to just go home and have a cup of tea and have an early night? And it's like, no, that's a waste of a life. I'm throwing my life away. So there are some things that are just elemental. And as I say, that they're things that my younger self wouldn't have possibly imagined that I'd be interested in. But it sounds like with David Lynch as well. I mean,
do you like David Lynch, since you are talking?
Yeah, I do, because often with David Lynch, I find him fascinating and impossible to understand, which is why you want to keep going back for more. I mean, Mulholland Drive was fantastic. Blue Velvet made a huge impression when I saw that. And even The Straight Story, which is sort of like the most un-David Lynchian film he could make.
Yes.
Twin Peaks, I couldn't get my head around that whatsoever. But maybe that there's time in the future for that. But how did the David Lynch enthusiasm come about?
I think it was one of my professors at university. It was actually my former mentor, and he is now retired. He used to be professor of Indian philosophies and religions, and I just adored him. He was a person that I actually still look up to. And yeah, he told me that he thought I might really like David Lynch, and he was the first person who ever mentioned this director to me and his films. And yeah, and then I, which one was, which was the first film that I saw? I think the first one was Mulholland Drive. And it was just, whoa, what is this? I want more. Yeah, I guess that I really like David Lynch's films because apart from the kind of game that it triggers that you want to understand and pick up all the clues to wrap your hand around what he wanted to say, but even if you don't really understand them, it's just a mixture of the atmosphere, the images, the photography, and the music, everything combined together. It just, I don't know, it's kind of, it's like a punch in the stomach.
Yeah, it's like a dream. It's like when you're watching his films sometimes, particularly when he has lots of like kitsch music from the 50s against a very contemporary backdrop of murder and deceit and surprise and skullduggery and all the rest of it, and you kind of feel that it's like a dream. It feels like it's operating within the contours of the way a dream can work, where things don't make sense but they're fascinating. You know, dreams, sometimes we can spend our whole lives trying to work out what a dream might have meant, and his films seem to be at that very elemental level, trying to sort of work through that side of the psyche that nothing else sort of really fits with, the things that reason doesn't work with. But David Lynch, I don't know if you've heard him being interviewed, but he's fascinating because he, you know, I think some people are saying, I think I've cracked it, I think I know what you were doing Mulholland Drive, but rather than say that's right or whatever, he's quite opaque, and you sometimes think, do you know what you were doing with that? It's almost as though the filmmaking for him is sort of where he's being almost in possessed by this sort of great exciting current of mystery and mythology, and it's not as though he has a particular game plan, it's not as though he has a particular agenda, he's just working through his own psyche, and it's fascinating to watch, and it's very collective at the same time.
Yeah, I think that sometimes we overrate how important it is to understand things from a logical standpoint. Sometimes even just feelings and the experience that you get, even if it is an experience that is not really understandable, that you cannot just reason around it, but it is something that just changes you or just shakes you at a very deep level. And as you said, as with dreams sometimes can just really have a great impact on you, even if you are never going to understand their hidden meaning. Maybe in some case, it's not really about understanding the meaning of things. Maybe it is about being open up to an experience that goes beyond our reasoning mind.
Yeah. And it sounds as though you're able to channel a lot of that through your research as well. So I can see how this is how it all started for me. I'd be spending the day writing on, I don't know, the doctrine of hell or something like that in Christianity when I was doing my master's. And then I'd watch a film of an evening like The Witches of Eastwick. And I'd think, this is really interesting because this film is dealing with the same topics, but in a way that I could never write about, you know, because I'm dealing with academic sources rather than filmic sources. And that's what made me do the PhD, because I thought I needed to square this circle. It was like, I need to be able to draw on these films as resource material. But because I'd never done anything like that before, that wasn't the way I was taught. I only ever wrote essays, should we say. Then in that sense, I kind of changed broke the mold for me. I'm not, other people may have found it less of a surprise, but it did feel that there was material that we could draw on. But you need to have the basics in place. And that's the other thing as well, to do like the work you do on magic or stuff on film. You know, you also need to know what the disciplinary parameters are. You need to know what you're up against, as it were, then in order to be able to follow it, because you need to have a methodology, you need to have a shape, you need to have some kind of disciplinary parameters, even if you're then going to critique them. But, you know, so that sort of thing can only happen much later on. You need to sort of know what religion is in order to then to be able to see how it interacts with film. You can't just start with the film and say, oh, I know all about religion through the film. It has to come from somewhere else. So it's a journey, an adventurous journey that takes you through many degrees and many levels of understanding professionally professionally and personally. Is that something that you found was the case?
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you. And I think that it is important to stick to a very rigorous methodology and a rigorous structure before trying to do something new. So you really have to learn how things work before you start and to try and give your own contribution to the field. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is absolutely important. I think that there was a quote from Picasso which said, "Learn the rules like a master to break them like an artist," or something like that. So the idea is that you really have to, even in art, when you do something very abstract, you still need to learn and to know all the classical methods and structure to do things in order to break those rules in a way that is, you know, that makes sense somehow.
And actually, that's a really good way of putting it. In order to break the rules, you need to know what the rules are. You can't, to break it, you have to, and also respect the rules in the sense of you might want to challenge them, but you there's no point knocking something over when, unless what's there in its place is something that's able to engage with something. There has to be something there to engage with. If you knock it down, then it just becomes a rant rather than a critical exercise.
Yeah, it's like writing a poem. You need to learn the language and all the rules of the language before you start and play with the language in a way that goes beyond grammar and syntax. Yeah, it is. I absolutely agree that, especially in my case, doing something which is perhaps not as common to do in academic circles, but it is still it is extremely important to abide by a rigorous methodology so that you can also enter in communication and in relation to the field and the existing literature, because otherwise you are not really doing research. You're just rambling about things. But in order to do research, you have to kind of enter in a dialogue with what exists already. And because research is, in my opinion, I think that research is a network. It's not something that can work in isolation. So you cannot really, even in my case, where my research was really new and there was nothing published on the topic, but even in that case you are still placing your research within a wider field. Maybe there have been other people in other countries, or even different elements of your research have been studied by other people, and even when they have been applied to different things or different elements or different situations, you still have the bones of what that research was about, and you can enter in a dialogue with what had been done previously so that you can add your own study to that in a way that it makes sense. As I said, it's like learning a language, and then after you've learned it, you can start playing with it and do, for example, a poem or a pun. So,
well, that's why education is such a lifelong journey, isn't it? Because otherwise, if we all sort of said right at the age of whatever age, 11, 15, 18, 20, whatever, we said, right, we've done it, we've mastered all the basics, and therefore there's nothing more to know, then that would feel also really anticlimactic. It's the same with you. You learn so much from your students. You know, I'm teaching my students, but they're also teaching me at the same time.
Yeah, that is really true. Sometimes we think, people may think of teaching as a unidirectional thing that you teach and students learn, but actually is more like a circle, is more circular. So you do learn. I do learn a lot from my students as well. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they come up with ways of looking at things that is really enlightening to me. And in other cases, even the kind of questions they pose, they can help you kind of remove yourself from a perspective from which you've always looked at a certain issue or a certain topic and start seeing it from a different angle. And when you do that, maybe even your understanding will expand.
Yeah, because you sometimes find if you're teaching the same module every year, and sometimes you think something's not clicking into place this year, but last year it did. So you're asking yourself why something once worked, but now it doesn't, or it might work in reverse. And you think, is it me? Is it the students? Is it the topic? Is it that somehow what we were talking about last year fitted with the particular, you know, zeitgeist, and this year it's something else? So I've, and one student of mine once wrote an essay on the particular topic, and she referred to the way that the students in the class apprehended the material compared to other topics. And she was like deconstructing my lecture as part of her essay. It was fascinating to watch. And I think that unless we're able to learn from that, then there's also no point. If it's unidirectional, it's a bit like, well, Karl Barth in Christian theology, you know, man speaks or God speaks and man listens. You know, it's almost that, you know, teaching then becomes you telling them. And to an extent, there has to be an element of you imparting information, because that's the job of a teacher. But also, I think the teacher needs to get, and you can only get the pupils, the students, to think differently if you can enter into their mindset. Otherwise, they won't listen. So if they know that you're receptive to them and they're receptive to you, then what unfolds is going to be this most enlightening religious, educational, spiritual odyssey.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so it is fascinating to teach.
Well, what I thought, just to, as we start to wrap up, Angela, I was just going to ask you some more philosophically based questions. Ooh. About how you got to, you know, where you are now. I mean, would you say, for example, that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you look back on your life and career?
Yeah, I guess the positive memories are more prevalent. Well, I have lived, of course, very, I mean, it wasn't like my life was all made of happy moments, but I guess that when I look back, I tend to, it's like the highlights take, I kind of see more the positives. I tend to see more the positives than the negatives. And even the painful and sorrowful memories that I have now, in hindsight, I see them as stepping stones, which shape the person that I am. So I'd say that, yeah, I tend to look back and I tend to see more the positive memories than the negatives.
Yeah, because my next question was going to be about whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. And I guess in the light of everything in 2020 with lockdown, I wonder what people in the future, what we are going to say about this year, because are we going to look back and say, this is like the most horrible year because we can't do the things we would normally, the things we take for granted? Or are we in some way going to look back and say, but we have the resources out of this horrible COVID background, the resources in place to do things in a very different way, and we rose to the challenge?
Yeah, I think that this situation has proven how much human beings are resilient and find different ways of doing things. So, yeah, of course, I guess that in every single scenario, in every single situation, there are positive aspects which give you something and negative aspects which take away something from you. Mm-hmm. So, in my opinion, it kind of depends on how you decide to look at things. And yeah, of course, pain and sorrow are part of life. But what you do with that pain and with that sorrow is up to you. So I like, as an optimistic person, as you may tell, I like to think that in 20 years, I will look back at 2020 and see it as surely as a dark time, but also, you know, the darkest night is the one that precedes dawn. So I will also remember that I finished my PhD and that I had an amazing community through YouTube, that I had the opportunity to speak with amazing scholars such as yourself, and that the technology really helped me to connect with people, which I'm really happy and honored to be speaking to.
No, and it works both, though. That's very kind of you. And it works both ways, because I think it would be very hard. I mean, maybe I shouldn't be using the analogy of the Viva, because you've got yours coming up, and I had mine 21 years ago, so I can speak with a bit of hindsight. But I remember talking to somebody who was saying about their Viva that they weren't looking forward to it. They said, oh, I hope it's very quick and I hope they don't ask me any difficult questions. And I thought the opposite. I thought, you know, the only people in the room who will have read my thesis, you know, well, they may be the only people ever who read the thesis, because, you know, obviously you're writing for a very select niche audience. But I thought, well, the whole point is, if I've been spending all these years working on something, well, I kind of need to be challenged. If somebody said to me, you got it, imagine I got a letter in the post saying, actually, you know, well done, you got it, I think, no, I have to go through that. I have to walk through fire. Otherwise, the rich, it's not done. And I think that's the thing in life, that sometimes the things that we were uncomfortable doing, once we've done them, we feel more resilient and we feel that we are amazing sometimes that we've done it. Whereas if it's all just sort of done for you, set out for you, life, take away the challenges from life, and then you take away the reason to get up in the morning, and then sometimes that's when the regrets, I think, sink in.
Yeah. Well, I still hope that I'm going to pass my Viva either way. But yeah, I understand what you mean. And now that mine is approaching, I have many scholars telling me it's going to be the only time when somebody really reads your thesis and will ask you questions and be interested in the answers. So,
well, that's all you can ask for as well, isn't it? Because you're passionate about what you're doing, that comes out in everything that you're saying. So in that sense, it can't not be an enjoyable experience in that respect, because it's your thing, it's a chance to talk on your territory, on your terms, about your work. So in that sense, there's an integrity to that process, which I think is really important. But what do you think your younger self would have thought about all of this? I mean, would you think that your teenage self would have been surprised that you'd have ended up doing this kind of work? Did you have different dreams? Did you have different anticipations when you were young about what you'd be doing with your life?
No, I think that my teenage self wouldn't be surprised at all. I guess when I was a child, I wanted to become a writer. And then since my teenage years, I've always wanted to be an academic, to study. I guess what I wanted to do since when I was, even when I was a child, was to study for the rest of my life. Because I remember that I was the crazy kid that used to cry over Sundays because I couldn't go to school. Because I thought the school was so exciting. Every time that I went there, I was about to learn so many new things, and that just excited me so much. And I got so invested in what my teachers used to, teach in the classes, that I do remember that when it came the time when my history teacher in elementary school, and when she was telling us about the fall of the Roman Empire, I remember crying because I got so invested with all the history, and it felt like, you know, like I was living it. And also, yeah, that knowledge was just enriching my life. So I guess that I always wanted to study for the rest of my life, which really suits the job of an academic.
Absolutely. No, it sounds like you've got it made. That's terrific. What about, are you in touch with friends from your past? Obviously, you're living in the UK now, and I guess through social media, it's very easy to keep in touch with. But are you academic friends, and school friends, are you still in touch with people from your past?
Yes. I have my two best friends with whom I interact each and every day. So we always message, you know, on WhatsApp, and we exchange voice messages, and sometimes we video call. So I have two best friends with whom I'm in contact each and every day. And also there are friends from school and friends from university, which I'm occasionally in contact with, but not on a daily basis. But yeah, I guess that my oldest friends are, of course, clearly people from Italy. So at the moment, I'm not very pleased that I'm not going to be able to see them for the foreseeable future. But yeah, when we will meet again, it will be twice as...
It'll be even more spectacular.
Yes.
But my very last question, Angela, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Both. More looking forward, perhaps, but I guess that I'm very nostalgic, such as yourself. So I'm a person who always looks forward to what's coming next, but always having you know, bearing in my heart all the memories of all the things that have shaped the person that I am. And I always, as you do, ask myself, oh, is this something that my teenage self would have done? Is this something that my child self would have done? What has changed? And am I happy for this change? So, yeah, I guess that I'm a look forward person with nostalgic tendencies.
That is a perfect answer. And on that note, Angela, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me, Chris. This was really fun.